Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am Ajito Ryo Master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Right here on the Absolution Network. I welcome you to another fabulous episode, as I am your Promptom host, Thomas Promptom Mattis, and I welcome you back to Disney Month. Yes, this is Disney Month here at the Absolution Network. All of February, we, at least on Tom's Prerogative, are reviewing Disney movies. And like I said before, I'm going to try to get one from each era. And in this case, in this episode, the era we're choosing is the 1980s. Technically, it is the 1980s, since it got released in 1989. Yes, I am, of course, talking about Walt Disney's classic that, you know, launched everything. It launched what Disney considers its golden age of animation, what I consider the golden revival of animation in America, the return of, as far as I'm concerned, the return of the anime style, to Walt Disney for the first time since Walt Disney and Sleeping Beauty, which is something I'll get into a little bit later. I would say I'm going to get into it later. Hopefully I'll remember to get into it later. But yeah, Little Mermaid, which came out 1989, it launched all of that. It launched the idea that animation could be more than just something for kids, which was one of the greatest things that could ever happen to animation. And it does sort of bring up some sad things the way animation is looked at now, but I actually will get into that a little bit later, because I actually do have a note on that as I look down to make sure my notes have that. Yeah, I do. It's not technically down, but I do have a feeling I'll probably go into that whole thing I'm talking about, but yeah. So, Little Mermaid. Before we get into cast and synopsis, actually, we don't have any emails or comments and that stuff, but the thing I want to get into is, I actually want to kind of get into a bit of the history of The Little Mermaid so you can understand the culture and some of the stuff that was going on at the time. It's something I kind of stayed away from when I was reviewing Sleeping Beauty, because I didn't feel like it had a place in the review, but looking back, I kind of feel that I should have at least talked about it a little. There were places I went into it specifically when I was talking about Ivan Earle and why he had so much control. But, you know, I didn't go so much into the history as I probably should have, I felt. And I feel that the history with these Disney films, it's important to understand the culture going on at the studio and everything surrounding it. So, basically, Little Mermaid got started actually the mid 1980s, production at least. It was around the time that Michael Eisner and Frank Wells had taken over Disney, well, not taken over, but had been given ownership as like CEOs and taking control of how the day-to-day operations of the company. And of course, so this led to many things going on, them bringing Jeffrey Katzenberg from Paramount to run the film division, which included the animation division. They brought in Roy Disney to sort of be a morale boost, but, you know, also oversee the animation part of it. Peter Schneider, who helped during the film. You know, all these new people decided to take a new direction, especially considering that around the time of them taking over, it was around the release of the Black Cauldron, which was just a complete mess in design. We're going to bring Disney back to its prevalence. In fact, actually, at this time, there were some thoughts, of, Michael Eisner. I don't know if Michael Eisner directly, but a lot of people may be on the board of axing, insane as it might be, the entire Disney animation, not building. Well, they wanted to build it for other reasons, but the whole part of the film business side of Disney, they thought doing away with the animation part of the company, which, is asinine to think when you think about Disney, but it was actually being thought of. And again, a lot of this stuff is stuff I've learned from documentaries and reading on the subjects, mind you. That's why I always suggest getting the special edition of these DVDs and watching the comments on, or the commentary, and more importantly, the extras of how it's made. And again, there's also one of the greatest documentaries I've ever watched, which is Waking Sleeping Beauty, which is just an absolutely fantastic documentary on Disney's golden revival and that whole time period. So, all this is going on. Little Mermaid was actually an idea of, I believe Ron Lassinger. I may be remembering wrong. But he had, there had been this point where they brought an idea of forming ideas called the Gong Show, where people throw ideas, and if it was bad, it gets gonged. If it like it, it gets put in production. He brought in The Little Mermaid, which initially got gonged, but upon reading the small little synopsis that he had written, Katzenberg liked it, gave it the go-ahead. They ended up hiring Howard Ashman and Alan Menken to do the songs. This is the first one they worked on. And production started, and we'll get more into sort of the what was going on during production and certain parts. But magic just happened. Lightning got caught in a bottle, and Little Mermaid came out. It made tons of money, and it put Disney animation back where it belonged. All along with, the animation studio trying to prove itself that it was worth something to the company. I mean, you gotta realize the animators were literally moved off the Walt Disney complex and moved into trailers on Flower Street in L.A. So, or I should say in Glendale, mind you. I guess that's part of the whole L.A. metropolis. I actually haven't been in California for years, so I apologize if I'm getting that wrong. So that's sort of a look into the history that was going on with The Little Mermaid. And we'll get into some more of that as we go on with the review. So let's get into cast and synopsis. First cast, Jodie Benson plays Ariel, the Little Mermaid herself. Christopher Daniel Barnes.
Oh, Mary Jane! Mary Jane!
Plays Prince Eric. What do you mean, what was that? Oh, that was the Christopher Daniel Barnes.
Oh, Mary Jane! Mary Jane!
Alarm. Every time we say his name, we're obligated to play that. But anyways, Pat Carroll plays Ursula, the Sea Witch. Samuel E. Wright plays Sebastian. Jason Myrn plays Flounder. Buddy Hackett plays Scuttle. Kenneth Mars plays King Triton. And Ben Wright plays Grimsby. The story of The Little Mermaid follows a Little Mermaid by the name of Ariel, who is 16 years old, and is the daughter of the Sea King, King Triton, who controls all the power under the sea. She loves exploring and is fascinated by the human world and the world above the waves, but it is unfortunately, her father doesn't share her same view of exploration and wonder of the human world, being that they are nothing but fish eaters that want to catch every fish on their hook, and forbids her from exploring the world. One night, she comes upon a ship, a human ship, and meets and falls in love with a prince named Eric. All of a sudden, a storm comes out of nowhere and basically sinks the ship, and Prince Eric is drowning but is saved by Ariel. She brings him upon shore, and the only memory he has of her is her beautiful voice as she sings to him. Ariel was madly in love with Eric, but her father, King Triton, finds out and absolutely forbids her to see him going to the lengths of destroying her room and destroying all her lovely treasures she's gathered of the human world to prove his point. This, of course, drives Ariel to see the sea witch, Ursula, who makes a deal to give her human legs to allow her to travel on land for her voice. And as the deal goes, she has 3 days to make the prince fall in love with her and give her a kiss of true love. Ariel signs off on the deal, manages to make it to the surface and on shore with her friend Flounder, Sebastian, and the Scuttle, and is just so happened found by the prince and brought to the palace. For the next 2 days, she spends time with the prince, and they slowly start to fall in love and almost kiss if it wasn't for the mingling and prevention by Ursula's two flukies, Jetsam and Flotsam. Or Flotsam. I'm probably getting that name wrong. I apologize. This, of course, causes Ursula, who this whole time had been using this as a plan to try to blackmail Triton to giving her his power, to take matters into her own hand and transfer herself into a beautiful maiden with Ariel's voice, and seduces the prince into marrying her. As they go off to get married on the third day, towards sunset, Scuttle, flying by on the marriage ship, sees Ursula's reflection in the mirror, and that this beautiful woman is not who she is, and it is really Ursula the Sea Witch, telling Ariel, with the help of Flounder, swims towards the marriage ship while Sebastian goes get the king. Meanwhile, Scuttle calls all the animal friends he can find to help stall that wedding. They do a good job, and they actually manage to break her seashell that Ursula had around her neck that was containing Ariel's voice, which gives her back her voice. And just as it seems like her and the prince are going to kiss, unfortunately, sunset happens, and Ariel turns back into a mermaid. Ursula releases her disguise, grabs Ariel, and goes back into the sea, where they run into King Triton. But because the deal that Ursula had made with Ariel was binding, Triton can't stop its power and ends up making a deal with Ursula to trade his soul, basically, for Ariel's, which allows Ursula to gain Triton's power. She then tries to turn and kill Ariel, but Prince Eric comes to the rescue. From there, a fight breaks out to where Ursula accidentally kills her poopsies, Jetsam and Flotsam, which causes her to get mad and cause a giant whirlpool as she goes after Eric and Ariel. She splits Ariel from Eric and tries to destroy her, but Eric manages to get on board one of many sea wrecks that the whirlpool conjures back up to the surface, rams it into Ursula, therefore impaling her and causing her to electrocute herself, destroying her. This frees all the souls that she had captured before, including King Triton, who gets his power back. At the end, Eric makes his way back to the beast where he's resting, and Ariel is preparing herself to say goodbye, realizing that she'll never see him again. When Triton realizes the errors of his ways of not allowing his daughter to follow her heart, and gives her legs and allows her to live on land with Eric, and Eric and Ariel get married and live happily ever after, the end. It's such a nice story, isn't it? Well, with that being said, let's get right into our review of The Little Mermaid.
Be where the people are. I wanna see 'em dancing, walking around on those, what do you call 'em? Oh, feet. Flipping your fins, you don't get too far. Legs are required for jumping, dancing, strolling along down a, what's that word again? Street. Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they stay all day in the sun, wandering free. wish I could be part of that world.
And now we start with music. And let's talk about the overall style of the score. There's really two things to really talk about that in that sense. And one, it has to be acknowledged that being at Howard Ashman and Alan Menken have been brought in, the score itself is really a Broadway-style score, where the music itself and the songs, mind you, move the story along. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But the other thing they do is the overall style is of Calypso and Caribbean, which, again, 1980s was really a new sort of musical style, really only recently being introduced into America. I mean, there had been, you know, I'm blanking on the name. I should know the name because I'm actually wearing a shirt of his right now. Bob Marley had been part of the, yes, and so he has sort of the same style. But overall, there hasn't been a sort of big, complete influence into the mainstream of America. And so it was a fairly new music style. And it really works to absolute perfection. It fits the theme, especially when they're under the sea. Just some great instrumentals used with, you know, xylophone and sort of steel drums. I love steel drums. One of my favorite, I'm a percussion player myself. But even with that being said, one of my favorite instruments is the steel drum. I just love the sound of the steel drum, and it's very prominent here. Just the different tunes you can play. Again, coming from Florida, you know, you'll go to the beach and you'll see somebody that has a steel drum and that's playing it. I very much love the use of steel drum in the score itself. I mean, the score itself is beautiful. It's a great mix between that Calypso Caribbean style and sort of, I want to say, Mediterranean sort of positivity. I'm trying to find the words to describe it, but it's something to where it makes you feel like you're under the sea a lot of times. You know, when you listen to sort of the melody of Part of Your World, it's sort of this hopeful song, but at the same time, when you put it into the context of thinking water, 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 and under the sea, the way the music itself flows sort of fits with that sea theme. Same thing with, you know, When They're on Land. When They're on Land, actually, a lot of the music comes from the same melody as what's actually the first song in the movie itself, which is Phantoms Below, which is really only a short reprieve that they do at the beginning of the movie. But it sort of has the same sort of grand sea adventure feel to its music. So overall, I just love this score. It fits perfectly with the animation that's appearing on screen. And they use the score to perfect balance, and it flows with the story, perfectly. So I like that about that. So yeah, the score itself, outside of the song, because everybody pays attention to the songs, as we're going to get to in a moment, but just listening to the melodies and sort of the background music, yeah, they fit the story and they help the story flow itself. I think it's very much an underappreciative part of The Little Mermaid. So, yeah. With that, we're going to move on to the other talking point we have with music. And that's Howard Ashman and Alan Menken songs. And again, here's what we're going to talk about, you know, their meaning to the story, as we'll also talk about a little bit later. Like I said, this was a move to a Broadway-style sort of musical. And what that means is, anybody who's watched a Broadway show, or even an opera, or any type of stage show that uses music, the songs in it are very important because, to an extent, they are the dialogue. They are the exposition. The songs tell important parts of the story. They tell of feelings that are going on within the characters. Their exposition, their emotions, their dialogue of the story itself, and they help move the story along. And you have that done to wonderful, wonderful, wonderful effect. Here in The Little Mermaid. Like I said, Phantoms Below, which is a very short reprieve, sort of a sailor song, to say, which is sort of a great setup for what happens with the fish going in and, you know, telling these tall tales that the seamen tell of, you know, the mermaids that live under the sea, and they're not myths or legends, they're real, I tell ya, and you sort of believe it, and then you see the fish go, and then you slowly see the undersea world and the mermaids, and it eases you into that. It's done to a perfect flow, a perfect consistency, and it helps you believe in the fact that, hey, these things aren't myth, they're real. It immediately helps you realize that it's real. Of course, it opens to that one of the best opening or introduction shots of a kingdom or anything, and where you see King Triton's palace. But let's get to our real first song that really comes up in, well, the first real song I want to get to is Part of Your World, but we do have, you know, Phantoms Below and sort of the opera song that's sung at the musical that happens that Ariel doesn't appear at, but they're consonantal songs. They don't have their place. They do have their place, but I just don't feel they're as important as the other songs that I do have listed. But again, Part of Your World, when you think of Little Mermaid, this is the song everybody thinks of. This is the song that won awards, along with Under the Sea, and it is just a beautiful song. And I think the thing I love most about this song is just how wonderful it portrays the emotions of Ariel. You know, you think, oh, she's just a whiny 16-year-old girl, but you really get to take a look into her psyche and what she's feeling. You know, she's not just some whiny 16-year-old girl who just, you know, wants a new toy. She does want something more. And while it may not be something as sort of grand of what Belle asks for when Beauty and the Beast is done, it is something to wanting to be something similar, just not quite. You know, she wants to explore. She wants to go beyond the realm. She wants to open up her horizon, per se. You know, she knows there's more to learn out there. And, you know, she loves to learn. You know, you're given that thought process from the song of how much she loves to learn, how much she's just intrigued by these things from this other world that she can't be a part of because, you know, she has fins. You know, the whole line of flipping your fins, you don't get too far. Legs were required for jumping, dancing, strolling along down that, what do you call it? Street. Yes, I've sing the Part of Your World a lot of times. I do know the song by heart. As I actually do Under the Sea and Kiss the Girl and Poor Unfortunate Souls, but Poor Unfortunate Souls not as much. But yeah, I love singing a lot of these songs, this one included. So, but you know, that part right there, you know, that it really gives you the insight of, though she wants to explore, she loves to learn, and she wants to explore this world that she can't be a part of because she has fins, but she can't, you know, because I don't want to use the word obstacles, but you know, just walls that are put in front of her that prevent her from doing, and that need, that sort of want to reach out and touch and be a part of that world, to explore that unexplored world, knowing that it's not just as something as simple as what her father says of it being nothing but barbarians and fish eaters. You know, she knows it's something more, and she knows that what her father, you know, it says is, I don't want to use the word discriminatory, but is sort of absent-minded and one-sided of a view based off a history maybe not quite as well understood. It does create a very bright contrast to the original Hans Christian story, as we'll talk about later, to the whole idea of there being this little mermaid who just wants to be outside her class, not understanding that you should cherish what your class is in. Again, we'll get to all of that later. So yeah, Part of Your World, wonderful song. I love it. Favorite part of the song, mind you, is, you know, what would I give if I could live out of these waters? What would I say if I could spend a day warm on the sand? Bet you on land, they understand that they don't reprimand their daughters by your women, sick of swimming, ready to stand. You know, there's just an intensity to that part of the song. It just brings you into, you know, this need of this character, and I love it so much, and it's so wonderful, and I love the use of words by Howard Ashman himself. Alan Menken's music is beautiful here. It's just wonderful. The next song is Under the Sea. Again, sung by Samuel E. Wright, because it's sung by Sebastian. This is the song where Sebastian is trying to convince Ariel that other world that she so desperately wants to explore and see, you know, it's got nothing. And this is just a fun song. Actually, before I continue on Undersea, I actually forgot a very important thing to talk about with Part of Your World, and I apologize. And I'm glad I caught myself before I got too much into Under the Sea. And that is that Part of Your World actually almost didn't make it into the movie, as shocking as that seems. In one of the first pretest showings where they brought a bunch of kids in, they were showing pencil tests in the song, and apparently a little boy dropped his popcorn and he became preoccupied with trying to get it cleaned up. Well, Jeffrey Katzenberg, and if you actually have the special edition DVD of Little Mermaid, they talk about this, and he even admits he's embarrassed he even thought about this. This even went into his mind. He's even embarrassed by the story, but that told Jeffrey, as insane as I think anybody can realize, that, oh, well, the song's boring and that they need to take it out. And, you know, Howard and Alan and the directors, Ron and Clements and Ron and, I'm blanking the name and I apologize, and Glenn Keane, who had animated the scene, who was a wonderful animator. I mean, again, and we'll talk about animators in a little bit, that were just, you know, oh my god, how could they even think about this? And I just love Glenn Keane's argument that apparently he told Jeffrey Katzenberger, like, Jeffrey, you can't, you know, surmise the whole importance of the scene and where to cut it based off the, you know, the actions of one hyperactive kid. And they eventually got enough of a reprieve. It came back and people liked it and stayed in. But I just think it's a funny story. And sort of represents sort of the culture and time that was going on in, you know, this animation. It really signifies that this animation, everything was riding on this animation. And, you know, these songs working. And so it's not important to the review, but I felt that was a funny story to share. So take it for what it is. But let's get back to Under the Sea. As I said before, Sebastian's song trying to convince Ariel. Just fun with this song. I love this song. Yeah. I think, above all else, this is the song everybody remembers and everybody remembers the lyrics to. You know, just so much fun with words. Again, that Calypso Caribbean sort of feel to the song. Well, not just feel, but, you know, theming and music that works so perfectly with the words. I think everybody tries to, you know, remember, you know, the words, you know, the middle part, you know, the new played flute, the cop, play the hop, the da da da. Oh god, now what a time to blank on the words. The new play the flute, the cop play the hop, the bass play the bass, and they sound and chop. The bass play the brass, the flute play the tub. The fluke is the Duke of Soul. The ray he can play, the lings on the strings, the trout rocking out, the blackfish he swings, the sprat and the sprout, they know where it's at, and oh, that blowfish blow. Yo, it's just a wonderful song, great use of words, and it's just the way it starts and the way it flows is just this excitement about being under the sea. And it just has that great comedic moment at the end to where they're all going, you know, they're coming to the finale and everything, and, you know, they go, duh! To where Ariel's supposed to be sitting, and she's gone because, you know, Flounder has brought her back to her little secret cave and where apparently he's moved the statue that was on the ship of Prince Eric to her cavern, which I still want to know how the hell he did that. But that's besides the point. But, you know, they're all there, like, Ariel? Ariel? And it's just got one of my favorite lines in the movie, in which Sebastian goes, "Somebody better nail that girl's fins to the floor." I just crack up with that line. It makes me laugh. There's actually many scenes that make me laugh. We'll talk about it a little bit later. But yeah, it's just a fun song. You know, it's just something to where I'll find myself just breaking into the song. Going, "Seaweed is always greener. Somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Just wonderful things around you, but more as you're looking for under the sea." You know, it's just something you can find yourself starting to sing and you just get into this song. And again, it's part of the joy of this movie is the songs are so wonderful to get into. So yeah, Under the Sea, absolutely spectacular song. Of course, the next big song which happens is, you know, Poor Unfortunate Souls. This is where, you know, Ursula is basically trying to, and again, I'm going off the, Roger Allens, I believe his name is, he's a storyboard editor, actually director as well, I believe he's part of the directing group that did Lion King, and he directed some other stuff. Big major part of Disney, you know, he does storyboards, and he sort of gives it this seductive, sleazy song, which I actually agree with him. I think that's one of the first things I come up with, but hearing him say it first sort of, you know, helped me figure out the words I wanted to say about this song. Because that's really what it is. It is this seductive, sleazy song to where Ursula is trying to con Ariel into signing this deal, you know. And just, Pat Carroll does a wonderful job singing the song. Of course, the thing she said, she admits she steals from Howard Ashman's them, you know, like, "Isn't it?" And, no talking, singing, zip. Which I can't do it as good as them. But it's just this wonderful villain song. It's, like I said, sexy, sleazy, seductive. It works so well, you can completely understand why Ariel gets conned into signing this deal. And just some wonderful lyrics. Again, like I said, I don't remember the lyrics as much as I wish to. But I'm trying to remember the words, but I'm blanking because, like I said, it's not the lyrics I remember the most. To be honest, it's not of the song. I love the song. It's just not my favorite of some of the other songs. But it's a wonderful, wonderful song. I love listening to it. I think one of my favorite parts is towards the end, and you have that build-up towards the ending of the song to where, you know, you have your looks, your pretty face, and don't underestimate the power of body language. It's that point at the end where you have all this buildup, and you get to the point where she goes, "Now, Jetsam Flotsam, I gotta go, the boss is on a roll." And you have that great finale part that I think sells the song for me, personally, where you're "Poor, unfortunate souls." I think that sells that for me. At least this song, that's what sells this song for me. It's a wonderful villain song. I think it's one of the top five villain songs of all Disney, of all time. Next one isn't a song that I think most people think about when they think about Little Mermaid. It is a song that's not, it's, I think, a little bit more important than Fathoms Below. It's sort of an opera song. And it really has no part in the story other than it's really a comedic song. It's sort of a rest from the main story. And it's this side story that does get resolved by the end of the film. And that's when Sebastian gets stuck in the kitchen and the song of the chef, Le Croissant. Le Croissant, Le Croissant. I love Ketchum. and eat little fish. Dun, 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 dun. But yeah, it's just such a fun song. It has a lot of comedy in that scene that just makes me laugh very hard. And it's sort of a very Looney Tunes scene, which I think that's something else that makes me sort of joyous, is that it's sort of a classic pratfall and all these things. You know, mind you, there's a lot of comedy going on this time. There's, you know, the whole scene to where Ariel is in the castle, and of course she takes the fork, which Scuttle earlier in the film told her it's a dinglehopper that brushes your hair. Of course, we know it's a fork that gives the food, and she starts brushing her hair with it, and they're looking at her like, what the hell is wrong with you? That makes you laugh so hard. It really does. And of course, the whole blowing of the pipe is another great, you know, pratfalling bit right there. Ron Clements and why am I blanking on the name? I shouldn't remember the name. In fact, I know I'm stalling here, but let me see if I can find their names. Because these guys also ended up doing The Princess and the Frog, and this is why I hate why they don't have like credits on the end of the back of the movie for Disney films. Sorry for that. But anyways, yeah, so they're well known for their comedy. I hate that I'm blanking on the last guy's name. I really hate it. That's something that's going to stick with me. But anyways, again, with this length of song, it's just this fun comedy song. Great comedy in it. And then I love the sort of short instrumental reprieve at the end where Sebastian finally defeats him. It's just fun and I like it. Moving on to the last song, Kiss the Girl. You know, I think this is one of the best romantic songs in Disney history. It definitely right up there with Beauty and the Beast and Whole New World. It's such a wonderful song, and sort of the seductive slowness of this song, I think, what makes it work so well. You know, it starts slow, but as it comes up, it builds, but it doesn't build up too quickly. You know, I mean, its pace quickens, but not too much, and it sort of still refrains sort of its slow nature that really gives it a romantic vibe, and it's done perfectly in, you know, the movie. Howard Ashman's lyrics here are just wonderful. You know, now's your moment. Sitting in a blue lagoon. Boy, you better do it soon. No time will be better. You know, just some wonderful lyrics. Like, oh man. Blanking on... blank of all times to start blanking. Because that's what you want in a host, to blank. but, you know, and again, that towards that end, just the sort of the funness of the song and just sort of the... A parade of love, I think, is a great way to put it. It's like, you know, sort of, you know, this whole cheering on, and of course, at the end, you have all the kissing, sort of romantic sounds from the birds and the frogs, and you have sort of these kissing sounds and all that stuff going on. It's they're going, kiss the girl, kiss the girl, kiss the girl. It's like, you know, that cheering on for them to kiss, and then kiss, and then, of course, the ultimate irony of them being flipped over by Dissom and Flotsam. But it's a wonderful song, and it sort of does this great job of portraying their love. You know, they only have a short amount of time to fall in love, or at least Ariel has a short amount of time to make him fall in love with her, and the ability for them to fall in love without her being able to speak, and for it to happen through song, it's just a wonderful combination, and it really makes you believe in this love that's happening between them is more than just now because she has this wonderful voice and she saved them. There's now a connection between these two characters that you can believe in that is more than based off of looks or voice. There is a natural love between them that's organic and, like I said, feels natural. And this song is part of it. Again, just it's smooth jazz number that sort of fits with that Caribbean Calypso style. Samuel E. Wright does a wonderful job singing the song. So that's it with music. with music. Oh, man, I wanted to talk about more about lyrics and sing more lyrics, but yeah. You probably don't want me singing anyways, but that here or there. With that being said, let's finally move on to animation, and we're going to do that right after a word from our sponsors.
December 7th,
Earth 2,
1941.
A world very much like our own, yet slightly different.
A date which will live in infamy.
A world at war.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Following the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt brought together the largest group of mystery men ever assembled to battle the Axis powers. Tales of the Justice Society of America presents the All-Star Squadron.
The Tales of the Justice Society of America, every Friday at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
And welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that word from our sponsors. With that being said, let's move on to animation. And the first thing we're going to talk about is the overall style of The Little Mermaid, its theme and everything. And I love the art style of The Little Mermaid. I love the color scheme here, just the light. And sort of, I don't want to say neon colors, but sort of the sort of sea colors that you have here with the reds and the greens and the light blues. And, you know, whether it be a very bright scene under the sea or on land to some of the darker scenes when they're at the ship or even in Ursula's lair, even as dark as those are, they're bright dark. You know, this is a great contrast from the movies of the past couple of years to where you had The Black Cauldron and Oliver and Company and The Great Mouse Detective to where there's much more brighter colors, and you can definitely see a return to grandeur in the animation from those past movies here, and you can understand sort of the complete renaissance. Really the first, I mean, they had worked on Oliver and Company and Great Mouse Detective, really starting with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but this was really the first, I want to say, project where the new generation of Disney animators, I think, really got to step on their own. I mean, Glenn Keane had been there for a couple of years, even though he's considered part of it. But when I talk about that, I'm talking about Mark Henn and Will Finn and Andreas Deja and James Baxter. You know, there's, you know, tons of the people that are very influential in Disney animation today. You know, those names that I just listed. Glenn Tisdale, who would go on to be a director for Beauty and the Beast and Hunchback of Notre Dame and Lion King and all of this, all these wonderful animations. You know, like I said, James Baxter, who designed, or at least Drew did the main character leads for Jessica Rabbit, who would do Belle, who's now gone on and works for DreamWorks and like has done work for Kung Fu Panda. And I know I'm going off on a tangent, but this is really that first time where all these people, all these all-stars, really were allowed to get together, and really the first project they worked on, and they did a wonderful job with the themes and the character designs and all of that. And just the first thing is, you know, there is a brightness to this theme, this sort of under-the-sea theme with the colors, sort of watercolor style. In fact, I think a perfect example of what this sort of, I want to say impressionist style is, overall art style, I think it's impressionist, is if you go to the scene where Eric's ship is caught in the storm, and there's a point where his wave, where a wave catches it, and they're like at the top of the wave. If you pause right as the lightning flashes and the screen's bright, you sort of see the clouds swirl around, almost like in a Van Gogh a sort of painting. And it's just sort of this impressionistic style, watercolors, and I mean, there's more modern animation that with the buildings and that stuff, but when like you're looking at the backgrounds, again, we'll get into this more when we get into backgrounds, this impressionistic style, but again, the brighter colors that really come out here, and it's, the art is wonderful to look at, just all the things to look at, especially when they're under the sea, the fishes and the animals and sort of the rock formations, it's just wonderful to look at. With that, let's move on to character designs. Ariel is just a wonderful design. There's a youthful quality, you know. This is something that always amazes me with the Disney princesses, especially among this time, is their ability to make them seem young, yet mature at the same time. There's maturity about her, yet she still seems young. I love her red hair. I think that was a much better choice, you know. Again, going back into those backstories, one of the things that were of contention in the making of this movie was what color should her hair be? Jeffrey Katzenberg apparently, you know, said the line, well, mermaids are blonde. Everybody knows mermaids are blonde. And Ron Clements and his partner said, does everybody know that mermaids are blonde? Ultimately, you know, the idea to go with a red hair was, you know, more and more accepted because it was really a better choice aesthetically. And they're right. I mean, when you look at it, red and green are colors that complement each other. It makes perfect sense. And, of course, a darker red is better than a darker yellow. But her color schemes just work perfectly. All the colors of her complement each other. I love the line work. You know, Mark Hen does a wonderful job drawing her. He does such wonderful work on drawing the princesses. I know he did Ariel. He did Jasmine, who he apparently based off his sister. And he did some, you know, other characters. James Baxter was, I think both him and James Baxter worked on Belle. Could be wrong on that, but that's here or there. But anyways, so yeah, wonderful character designs by Mark Hen. Just love Ariel's look. And it's, I think one of the things about it is when you look at her character designs, there's just a cheerfulness and a look of exploration. You know, here's a character, you look at it, you see a character like, this is an insightful, you're thinking character that loves to explore, and I think that's what I love about it most. Prince Eric, I love that he's not boring. I'm very thankful for that. I think the white, sort of, the predominant white color of him, I think was actually a good fit, considering just his personality. The personality of Eric is very much in contrast to sort of the other princesses, or I mean the other princes of past films. And really you can look at, you know, his personality and see sort of, you know, that being a beginning for the princes to come with Aladdin and the Beast and sort of the deeper meaning within the princes. Or excuse me, the princes themselves. So yeah, I very much like his design. I mean, of the character designs themselves, he's, along with probably King Triton, is probably my least favorite. But at the same point in time, I do like his character design. I mean, it gives a look, I think, into an insightful human being as well. Ursula, there is just a sleaziness to her design that's just wonderful to look at. But which, by the way, I love Pat Carroll's, people apparently call her an octopus. Pat Carroll, who is the voice actress of Ursula, always corrects people, as she says in the documentary, because she says she's so knowledgeable. She goes, it's not an octopus, it's squid. And they go, well, what's the difference? Well, she has 6 arms, which is cheaper to draw. As along the context of what, you know, she said, which I just find absolutely hilarious. Unfortunately, kind of right. 6 arms are cheaper to draw than 8. But it's a wonderful villain design. Another funny thing about this is her design is apparently based off Divine from Hairspray, who is a male cross-dresser in that play. Which, think about that for a second. Think about Mickey, Minnie, Goofy, Donald, and then Divine. One of these things is not like the others. So, yeah, it's... I love the design. I love sort of the sleaziness and the sort of the creepiness of her design. It's one of those perfect villain designs. And again, Andreas Deja, premier villain character designer for Disney. His villains are going to stand the test of time. You know, when you think about Ursula and Gaston and Beast. Not Beast, excuse me. Jafar. I want to say Scar and... why am I blanking on the one from Hunchback of Notre Dame? Oh, man, I apologize. But yeah, or at least I believe he did that. So yeah, he premiered... This is where he really started that trend of doing the villain characters that he does so, so well. And, like I said, sleaziness to the design that I love. Next, we have Sebastian Flounder and Scuttle. Sort of the supporting roles for Ariel herself. There's a playfulness with these character designs that I very much love. And also, if you ever get a chance to look at their voice actors, I also love sort of how the character designs of these characters, and this goes for all the characters, mind you, really matches the voice actors. If you've ever seen Samuel E. Wright, you know, sort of act, you know, Sebastian sort of has the same sort of facial twitches of Samuel E. Wright. Scuttle has sort of the Buddy Hackett. God bless Buddy Hackett. God rest his soul. I mean, he has sort of that great, especially is in the face, but the great sort of facial movements of Buddy Hackett himself as well. And so I also like that little nod to their voice actors to where the characters do look like them a bit. And then finally, final character to talk about is King Triton. And like I said, along with Prince Eric, probably my least favorite. But I do like them all. I love sort of the idea of him sort of being like a Greek god to an extent. Or a Greek... God, if I don't, kind of like, you know, how Zeus is to Hercules, and he has this sort of like, at least that's my first thought, you know, sort of the beard and everything, and to show his years and everything, and yet, I think that works perfectly with what his character is, yeah, he's been alive for all these years, and he has all this wisdom, and yet, he doesn't see what's right in front of him, as we'll get to when we talk about story. With that, let's move on to special effects. Now, we usually talk about action scenes here, and the action sequence, or the one action sequence at the end of the film, is absolutely spectacular. But I really want to use this time to talk about something, again, another underappreciated part, especially the Disney animated movies, and that's the special effects. And the special effects team is just wonderful in this movie. And that was before I saw the... if you have the Little Mermaid DVD, one of the extras is a look behind at the special effects themselves, which I was so happy they did, because it really is underappreciative, especially when you're looking at that, or should I say watching, the storm scene where Prince Eric's ship is caught in that storm. The special effects in that with the rain and the lightning and everything, it's just absolutely incredible. I mean, from that to the bubbles under the sea, to smoke and everything, it's done to wonderful effect. And, I mean, time for time, I'll just sit there and watch this movie and not even pay attention to the characters or anything going on screen. I'll just pay attention to the special effects going on in the movie because they're just so wonderful to look at. Wonderful, wonderful job. And then finally, we have the backgrounds, which, again, like I said, impressionist style. Wonderful backgrounds. I talked about sort of the background of that ship where you had the clouds looking at sort of reminds me of a Van Gogh painting. I loved sort of the choice of sort of, I would say maybe a southern Greek, southern Italy type of Mediterranean feel to the kingdom. I mean, one could say that, or maybe southern France, southern Spain. It really is the sort of southern European coastline there. I think the best way to put it is southern, or should I say, sort of the Italy, southern France sort of coastline there. I like that choice of backgrounds for the kingdom itself. And of course, under the sea, going with more of a Caribbean feel. I think at the end of the day, all these backgrounds mesh well together. And I love looking at the backgrounds. They're absolutely incredible. Whether or not there's a penis in the background, which... here's my thing to say about that. As far as penises being in the background of covers or whatnot, I'm sorry, if you look at a Disney cover and you see a penis, you're looking way too hard at the cover. Put it down. Have an 18-year-old scotch or whatever your preferred drink is, and relax. I mean, talk about having too much time on your hands, and relax. But anyway, so I love the backgrounds. So with that, that's really pretty much everything to say about art. Let's move on to story after a word from our sponsors.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and Beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And we're back, and let's move on to our final main theme, our story, and we're going to go right off. We're talking about the overall theme, because I think talking about the overall theme will be a perfect jumping off point to get into some of the other things to talk about with this story. Overall, again, it's a change from the actual fairy tale itself, which the main theme, as we'll get into, was sort of class and staying in your class. And overall, the theme of this movie is really following your heart, being who you feel you are. You know, and I think sometimes people do miss that about the film. Well, I think geeks miss that about this film. I think mainstream and mainstream America get that. I mean, that's why the movie did so well. But sometimes I feel as geeks, we over, or geeks and, you know, other podcasts and reviewers, and this is one of the few times where I'm actually going to talk about other podcast reviews of this movie. But I feel sometimes they overanalyze what's going on in this movie, and they just miss the point completely. It's about following your heart. It's about being yourself. You know, it's just a beautiful thing to watch. It's a very uplifting story about following what your heart desires, following who you are and being yourself. Now, I bring this all to light because of something that was really brought to my attention about how the way maybe some other reviewers, especially other female reviewers, apparently view this film. It was brought to light, for those who know, everybody knows of the Nostalgia Critic and everything like that, that guy with the glasses.com. And during the month of December, he did something called Disneycember, which he basically reviewed every Disney 2D hand-drawn animated film from from Snow White up to Winnie the Pooh. And when he got to Little Mermaid and he started talking about the sort of mixed feelings that female reviewers have a, you know, character and be centered around Ariel, he brought up a quote that apparently comes from the Nostalgia Chick, which is a female reviewer of That Guy with the Glasses, of you on Ariel in that fact. And she apparently says, and I quote, you know, she doesn't learn anything. She wants something. There's obstacles in the way. She gets what she wants. I kind of have a problem with that whole idea, because that's not kind of how things happened in this film. I mean, for one, Eric's not a thing. Nor is the feelings that she have for Eric a thing. You know, she's fallen in love. It's not like she wants an MP3 player here. Okay? And her father says no, but gets it anyway. She's fallen in love with Eric. Somebody her father disapproves of for biased reasons, which are very unfair to her. And it's her father that sort of pushes her towards what she does. Now, is the choice she made wrong? Absolutely. But she didn't wake up one day and say, ooh, I'm going to go to Ursula and make a deal for Legs and give her my voice. And, you know, allow her to have information to blackmail my father. No. Her father pushes her towards it. You know, you have that scene. It's a very important scene where Sebastian unfortunately lets go of the information that she's fallen in love with Eric, and her father, in a fit of rage, destroys her room and destroys everything she cares about and drives her to Ursula, who then cons her and seduces her into the deal. You know, it's not like she you know, you can say, yeah, she made a choice and she definitely did. But she wasn't probably thinking. Her emotions were taking over at that point, you know, because of what had happened with her father. And her emotions that, you know, she was trying to sort out about Eric, because she was in love with him and trying to coincide them with being, not being probably able to see her family again. Because you have that scene to where she's in Ursula's lair and she goes, well, if I make this deal, I'll never see my father or my sisters again. You know, she's struggling with that whole concept. You know, it's not like she just decides one day. So it's one of the reasons why I have an issue with that on that standpoint. I mean, you can't completely put the blame on her. The other part is, and something the Nostalgia Critic brings up, is that he says you can sort of make the argument that she apologizes, and the scene he points to is where she says sorry. Well, I'll take that further. It's not just that scene. The final scene in the movie, or one of the final scenes, to where she's on the rock looking at Eric, and Triton eventually gives her legs. But if you look at that before that he gives her legs, that is a very important scene, because it's a scene in two parts. One, it's Ariel recognizing her mistake and understanding that her own foolishness is probably costing her what she desires, and she's okay with that. She's understand that. She's ready to accept that punishment. You know. And then on the other side of that, you have King Triton, who sees that and understands that I've done wrong to her. You know, one kind of way I sort of look at the romance, or at least especially the way King Triton is looking at it, is sort of similar of interfaith relationships, to where, you know, the daughter brings home a man of a different faith or a different race or something, and her father, for whatever reason, whether he has race issues or faith issues or whatever, doesn't approve of it, and immediately is discriminatory towards her choice of boyfriend for no other reason that he just doesn't like his race or faith or whatever. It's very similar to that. There's a connection that one can make on this relationship with that. He is immediately discriminatory towards Eric because he's a human. And to his mind, all humans are barbarians that catch mermaids on their fish hooks. You know, regardless of how kind Eric is or whatever, or how different he is from that thought process, King Triton's idea of all humans is that they're barbarians, for good or for bad, for fair or unfair. So he's wrong about that. He drove Ariel, and he recognizes that mistake, that he's partly to blame. And so him giving Ariel legs was, you know, him giving Ariel his blessings and recognizing his own mistake. So it's not just that, oh, she didn't say her sorry, she didn't learn any lesson, no lesson was learned here, and she just got what she want. That, you know, these things were just obstacles. There were emotions at play. There were people's feelings at play. People made mistakes more than just Ariel. In fact, I'd be of the opinion that a lot of it is King Triton's fault for his own biased opinion and refusing to allow his daughter to be who she is. He made the mistake here, not Ariel. So to sort of say that Ariel is this whiny female character that ultimately gets what she wants, when she's not whiny, she's smart and intelligent, and she follows her heart in being who she feels she is. It's her father that's really the one against it, and is to an extent responsible for her making the deal and everything. So yeah, I feel placing all the blame of what happens in this film on her is not completely fair. I got into a rant there, but it is something I wanted to talk about. Again, that actually goes towards why I like Ariel so much as a female character. It also goes to why I love the romance between Ariel and Eric. This is a wonderful romance. really started this trend of sort of romances in a Disney film that are given a chance to build through the film. And Eric and Ariel just play perfectly off each other. It's wonderful to see Ariel's ingenuity is not the right word there, but just her fascination with the human world, her will to explore and want to, you know, see how everything worked. It's just fun, and it's pure filmmaking joy, to be honest with you. It's what filmmaking is about, sort of that exploration about things that are going on around her. And her and Eric, you know, the chance to build, and of course, like I said, the kiss the girl scene is absolutely wonderful. It's a natural, organic, well-flowing romance that builds. Yeah, it's 3 days, and it's the second half of the movie, but it still has enough time in it for you to believe in that relationship building. It's what makes, you know, him being seduced by Ursula after that day so sad. You feel Ariel's pain when she sees that they're going to get married. And, you know, them being together and stopping Ursula together, it just confirms, and more importantly, reaffirms sort of the relationship between the two, and it's wonderful to see. And speaking of the romance, you know, that is also a great segue into talking about, being that this was a romantic film, and again, the whole idea of following your heart of who you are, it is a great change from the original Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. And more importantly, I'm of the belief that films like this and Hayao Miyazaki's Ponyo film, which also is a Little Mermaid story with a happy ending, I feel that those films are better and far superior than the original Hans Christian Andersen. And the reason I think that is because if you take a look at the original Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid, it's a story that is really a story of its time. It's a time of sort of kings and queens, and it's a story about, you know, not overstepping your class, being happy with whatever class you're in. If you're middle class, be happy you're middle class. If you're poor class, be happy with your poor class, and not to venture out of your class. Well, that's really a concept that is really not popular, and in fact, goes pretty much against everything that America's foundation, mind you, let alone the world's foundation nowadays, is really about. The world has changed, and we are a world, and more importantly, our country is a country, mind you, as well, that is about transcending class. That if you don't like where you are, you can be anything you want. I mean, America's foundation, is the idea that a poor immigrant can come to this country, bust his ass, and end up a rich mogul millionaire. That's the foundation of our country. That you're not, you know, restricted to the class that you're in. And I think this story really sort of captures that spirit and the whole idea of the theme of following your heart about who you are. You know, that is a very American concept right there of you can be whoever you want to be. And as long as you follow your heart and work hard at it, you can be what you feel you want to be. And so I do like the fact that it changes that from the Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. I disagree with the fact that when you adapt something from a fairy tale, that you have to be just like the fairy tale. In fact, I'm of the opinion that part of what makes fairy tales survive over the years is adapting them to fit with the times. And like I said, the original Hans Christian Andersen theme really doesn't fit with our times. You could still tell that story, but it's not going to have the same impact, and it's not really going to match with the themes that are going on in this world. The Little Mermaid, the change is done with it from Disney. Yeah, it's Disney. Yeah, it has a happy ending because it's Disney. They can't kill her. But at the same point in time, that really is the better way to go. You know, really, sometimes I feel like the whole death of the Little Mermaid, it was just shock treatment added on by Hans Christian Andersen, to be perfectly honest with you. So, yeah, I definitely love this, and, you know, movies like Ponyo, their concept of sort of the happy ending of the Little Mermaid. Let's move on to the next talking point, which is talking about the Broadway style of the story, which we sort of went into earlier. But again, it has to be talked about a little bit more, because this was the launching point for more Disney animations taking that Broadway style. And that idea to where an equal part of the story is the songs. You know, that's why I talk about the songs that are going on, you know, from the overall theme, you know, part of your world. Again, that intuitiveness, there's an I word I keep trying to think of here that is sort of a same word as exploration or exploration. Oh, God, I need to get my thesaurus out. but, you know, Ariel's exploration, you know, wanting to explore, wanting to follow her heart, you know, again, portrayed in the Part of Your World song. You know, the sort of the con, the sleazy, seductive con of Ariel, who's high on, you know, very big emotions here of sadness for what her father's done and her wanting to follow her heart, but not wanting to betray her family. You know, she's very volatile at that point in time. And sort of the con, the like I said, the sleazy, seductive con by Ursula with Poor Unfortunate Souls. You know, it takes, those two songs are perfect examples of taking something that could take 10, 15 minutes to explain in normal dialogue and being able to compress it into a, you know, 4-minute song. And so you have all of that dialogue, all of that exposition in these songs that tell you the story. It tells you the story of her wanting more. It tells you the story of Sebastian trying to keep her, or her fins nailed to the floor, per se. It tells you the story of, you know, Ursula's con. It tells you the story of Sebastian and her friends trying to, you know, set the mood, trying to get Eric to kiss the girl so Ursula won't win. You know, it tells you all these important parts of the story, and at the same time compresses them down, and still are understandable. So, that's one of the strengths of a Broadway musical, is sort of that compression of major story points and important parts into song. And one of the things that makes it work so well, and this happens throughout all the Disney movies that are coming in this golden age, is the fact that, you know, they come straight out of the dialogue. You know, Part of Your World, you know, she starts, you know, she's talking, and the flounder goes, maybe he's right. Maybe all these things aren't worth looking for. And then goes, look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you say my collection's complete? You know, it flows from the dialogue. So, yeah, it's perfectly done there. So it's a very important part, sort of the Broadway style of the story. And I think it really helps convey the story to an important part. At the same point in time, I think sometimes people that are looking for a more literal sense of what's going on in the film can be sometimes confused. And it's really the only criticism I can really have of this film. But that's really not something that the story's fault. It's, again, it's a fault of the way maybe somebody may watch the film, which is very, very rare, to say the least. Let's move on to the final talking point. Now, again, as I've been saying all along, this movie was the launching point, especially because of how well it did, of the, or at least what Disney officials called the golden age of Disney animation. They've said that that's what they consider it, with things like Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, Lion King, so on and so on. I've said the golden revival of animation in the 90s, it's a big part of it because you had Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Then you had The Little Mermaid really set the stage for it being positive, and then you had things like Batman Animated Series and Animaniacs, Tiny Toons, and all of these great cartoons and American animes that came out. And again, as I said before, return of the anime style, the American anime style, which was, like I always say, first done with Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty, done here. I do consider this American anime. You know, for one instance, there's a scene where she's on the rock and she's singing that little reprieve of Part of Your World, and it has a close-up of your shot of her, close-up shot of her face. Don't look at that and don't tell me that that's not anime. It's one of those things where I look at that and I see anime just clear as day. I see the similarities of the character designs, especially character designs of characters from the 60s and 70s from Japan, alongside sort of the character designs of things like Sleeping Beauty. But I think it's more important to talk about here that what Little Mermaid did, it proved that animation can be successful. It proved the worth of the animation studio to the Walt Disney Company. It saved the animation studio from being axed. It really, like I said, it set the launching point for all these films to come. It's an important part of history, and it really is, because there are still some sort of art styles that sort of connected, I guess, to Oliver and Company and Great Mouse Detective and so on and so on. But it really is more important, I think, sort of that great gateway film. It's the gateway from old Disney of the set, or at least the Disney of the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, into the Disney of the 90s. And the animation, everything would just get better from there. It's a wonderful film, and at the end of the day, there's a reason this is in my top five of Disney films of all time. It's an absolutely gorgeous film. The songs are wonderful. The characters are wonderful. I love the characters. I love the comedy. So, Walt Disney's Little Mermaid final review, 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10, whatever scale you want to use. Not perfection, but yeah, 5 out of 5 for me. It's a wonderful film. So that's it for Walt Disney's Little Mermaid. If you guys have any comments about what I've said, want to disagree with anything I said, hate mail, fan mail, want to add to anything I've said, please feel free to do. I very much encourage it. In fact, send me anything. I will read it on the air. You can do that several different ways. There's our Facebook page, which you can find on Facebook by searching Absolution Network. You can leave comments on the post on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. You can email the show at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132, all lowercase, at yahoo.com. We still don't have iTunes up yet. The feed's actually been rejected, so we're working on hopefully trying to get it up. I have to work with Chris and hopefully get that resolved. So hopefully soon it will be up, but it has been sent into iTunes. It's just a matter of them accepting it. So I apologize for that, but hopefully once it's on iTunes, and if you're listening to this on iTunes one day, leave an iTunes comment. And that's all the ways you can get in contact with us. Remember to check out, of course, all my other shows, Tokyo SOS, like Godzilla Podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my comic book podcast, you can find at the Comic Book Crazy Podcast Insight, like Comic Book Crazy, and Hexcast, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. Remember to check out all our friends on the sidebar, like friend Donna Mark's Dragon Ball Z podcast, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box and From Crisis to Crisis, Scott Garner's 2-2 Freaks, Steven Slifer's Major Spoilers, of course, I talked about him earlier, but of course, the Stalzer critics, and that guy with the glasses, and all the stuff on there. So check them out. And that's it for this episode. Next episode, we're actually going to skip a decade and go into the thousands. You know, since we were talking about Ron Clements and his partner, we're going to talk about another film directed by them. That was a return to Disney's 2D hand-drawn animation that had everybody excited, and it's another kind of controversial and talked about film. That is The Princess and the Frog, a film that I love immensely and I can't wait to talk about next week. So until next time, my Toonami generation, stay gold.
A cursed samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort, but I am not worried, for one day you will fail.
By DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.